From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a crime writer who was once on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list, Edward Bunker started writing behind bars. His 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce, was adapted into the film Straight Time, which starred Dustin Hoffman. Bunker's new novel is due out this month. Actor Charles Dutton tells us how he discovered his gift for acting while serving time for manslaughter. He plays a sheriff in the new movie A Time to Kill. And Sean Penn discusses his portrayal of a death row inmate in Dead Man Walking and describes his own brief stay in jail. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Manny and Lo about two orphans who kidnap a mother surrogate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The House of Representatives has passed a 90-cent increase in the minimum wage. The increase has long been sought by Democrats. The bill includes more than $20 billion in tax cuts to entice Republicans to join them. The minimum wage would increase from $4.25 per hour to $4.75 per hour on October 1st. Next September, it would rise another 45 cents to $5.15. This is the first increase in the minimum wage in 5 years. The bill has been sent on to the Senate, where it's expected to pass quickly. President Clinton has promised to sign it. Searchers continue their work for more wreckage, or rather looking for more wreckage, of TWA Flight 800 in the Atlantic Ocean. Diving operations were suspended last night after 2 days of bad weather. They're expected to resume today. Beth Fertig, a member station WNYC, reports.
Federal investigators are still searching for critical evidence that could help them determine what caused TWA Flight 800 to explode more than 2 weeks ago. So far, chemical tests on portions of the wreckage have failed to confirm either of the leading theories, a bomb, mechanical failure, or a missile. The debris pattern has led investigators to believe the plane's front portion blew off first, and more pieces of that wreckage need to be tested to see if they were torn apart by a bomb. The Navy ship USS Grapple will send divers and a mechanical probe to search an area where the front section of the plane was discovered. Yesterday, the USS Grasp recovered a 45-foot section of the rear fuselage further east, but more than 90% of the plane remains underwater. So far, 184 of the 230 victims have been recovered. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Fertig in Long Island.
Algerian authorities report a French Roman Catholic bishop was killed in Algeria yesterday when a bomb exploded in his residence. It happened just hours after he met with a French foreign minister. Algerian officials say the terrorist act was aimed at both the Algerian and French governments. David Culhane reports from Paris.
The bomb was apparently the latest act of terror of militant Islamic fundamentalists determined to unseat the army-dominated regime in Algeria and to persuade France to stop economic, diplomatic, and military support for that government. Only hours before his death, Bishop Pierre Claverie and the French Foreign Secretary, Hervé de Charette, had attended a memorial service for 7 French Trappist monks who were also killed by the terrorists. The monks were kidnapped in March, and their throats were cut 2 months later. The Islamic fundamentalist campaign of terror started after the Algerian army aborted elections that Islamic parties appeared about to win in 1992. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 54 points at 5,648. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Former Nazi officer Eric Priebke has been rearrested. He was cleared yesterday of the most serious charges in a massacre of more than 300 civilians more than 60 years ago, but he'll now be extradited to Germany. An Italian appeals court must uphold this arrest within 4 days. Priebke was charged with participating in the murders of 335 Italian civilians. They were killed in retaliation for the murders of several Nazi officers. Priebke was convicted of participating in the murder, but acquitted of cruelty and premeditation. Syria says it won't accept a proposal which calls for Israel to pull its troops out of southern Lebanon if guerrilla attacks against northern Israel are stopped. NPR Sunni Khalid reports.
Syria attempted to end speculation about a secret agreement with Israel's new hardline government concerning Lebanon. Under the so-called Lebanon First proposal, Israel would withdraw its troops from the so-called security zone in southern Lebanon. In return, Syria would pull out its estimated 35,000 troops from Lebanon, and the Lebanese government would ensure that Hezbollah guerrillas would not launch cross-border attacks on northern Israel. In April, Israeli forces traded artillery and rocket fire with Hezbollah guerrillas across the Israeli-Lebanese border. About 150 people, nearly all of them Lebanese civilians, were killed in the two-week conflict. Since then, Hezbollah has continued a series of attacks on Israeli patrols in southern Lebanon, and there is growing public pressure in Israel to find a way to end its military occupation in southern Lebanon. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The attorney for Olympic security guard Richard Jewell is playing down a new report about his client. The Washington Post says Jewell told colleagues at his old job last May that he would be a hero at the Olympic Games. The Post reports his comment was used by authorities to get a search warrant to look through his apartment. The bombing killed one woman and caused a man to have a fatal heart attack. The attorney told NBC that Jewell just wanted to be on the spot to help people. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Edward Bunker is a crime writer who's never made it to the bestseller list, but was briefly on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Bunker, who is now in his early 60s, has been out of prison since 1975, but he spent nearly all his years before that, except those of his earliest childhood, behind bars. His crimes included robbery, burglary, and selling drugs. He wrote his first novel, No Beast So Fierce, in San Quentin. The novel, about an ex-con who can't get legit work and turns again to crime, was made into the film Straight Time, starring Dustin Hoffman. Bunker also wrote the screenplay for Runaway Train. He just completed a screenplay based on James Ellroy's novel Suicide Hill. Bunker's champions include Quentin Tarantino, who cast Bunker as Mr. Blue in Reservoir Dogs, and writer William Styron, who wrote the introduction to Bunker's new novel Dog Eat Dog, which will be published this month. I spoke with Edward Bunker in 1993, after the publication of a new edition of his 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce. Here's a reading from it.
I sat on the lidless toilet at the rear of the cell, shining the hideous bulb-toe shoes that were issued to those being released. Through my mind ran an exultant chant, "I'll be a free man in the morning." But for all the exultation, the joy of leaving after 8 calendars in prison was not unalloyed. My goal in buffing the ugly shoes was not so much to improve their appearance as to relieve tension. I was more nervous in facing release on parole than I had been on entering so long ago. It helped slightly to know that such apprehensiveness was common, though often denied, by men to whom the world outside was increasingly vague as the years passed away. Enough years in prison, and a man would be as ill-equipped to handle the demands of freedom as a Trappist monk thrown into the maelstrom of New York City. At least the monk would have his faith to sustain him, while a former prisoner would possess memory of previous failure, of prison, and the incandescent awareness of being an ex-convict, a social outcast. I finished with the shoes, set them beneath the bunk, and stood up. The cell was small, less than 5 feet wide. The bunk occupied so much space that my shoulder brushed against the wall as I passed by the bunk toward the front. How many hours had I spent in this cell, from 4 in the afternoon until 7 in the morning, for 8 long years? It was beyond computing in my mind. Now the cell was especially barren. I'd given away my small collection of books, the braided throw rug, the soap, shaving cream and toothpaste, everything. "Ah, screw it," I muttered, meaninglessly, without object in mind. I looked out through the bars, 13 of them, set so close together that only a hand and wrist could pass through. Around this cell were 500 others, most of them containing 2 prisoners. I'd angled a single cell after 5 years. We were all locked down for the night. A typewriter clattered nearby, a letter home or a petition for habeas corpus. Live steam in a pipe thunked and clanked. The loudest sound was several convicts entertaining themselves with a game of the dozens. It had been going on for half an hour, but only now caught my attention.
Thank you for reading that. Edward Bunker, do you know that on the author bio, on the press release that accompanies the republication of No Beast So Fierce, it says, Edward Bunker has not been arrested in over 20 years. It's an unusual thing to find on an author bio. Did you want that mentioned on there?
Yeah, sure I want that mentioned. Yeah, because, people have the image of the convict writer Jack Abbott kind of ruined things. And Smith and other people who, have written and have people who Buckley went to bat for Smith and mailer for Abbott, and, you know, and they got in trouble quick, you know, committed rapes, murders, robberies. You know, I'm somebody that's really been rehabilitated. So, I like the idea that I haven't been arrested for 20 years. You know, that's kind of changes things, you know. I mean, don't you think it's salient?
Absolutely. How many times did you get out of prison and end up going back in?
Three times. I was a three-time, well, you know, yeah, three times. I was a three-time loser.
Why is it so hard to live a straight life after prison?
The term habitual criminal is really an appropriate term. But there's a whole lot of things. One's life, you know, you're locked. When you're in prison, your dreams have no limit. There's not, you know, you can dream about anything. And the reality of the world is that when you get out, you're locked out of society. I mean, there's really the idea of the prodigal is really not accepted too much in Puritan America. I mean, I've had people tell me that they shouldn't allow me to write, and, you know, just you're locked out of society. That's an essential fact once you've been in. And you're accepted, and you have a group that you're accepted by.
In prison.
In prison, amongst thieves and criminals. And
now, your novel, No Beast So Fierce, has been republished. You wrote this book while you were in prison?
Yeah.
Were you encouraged to write while you were in prison?
When I was real young, I was encouraged to write. There was an old silent film star that used to write me from the, correspond with me and sent me magazines and subscriptions to the New York Times, and she encouraged me to write. And I'd read the I read a lot, and I'd read that. I know that Cervantes wrote part of Don Quixote in prison, and that Voltaire was in prison. And actually, if you go all the way back to Socrates, you know, that was the first prison writer. And there's been Genet, and so, you know, there's a lot of examples of people who have used time in prison to write books.
You were aware of that while you were writing in prison?
I wasn't aware of that when I first started. I don't all of that much. The first thing that I had was Chessmen. I was up in the hole, which was right behind death row, when Carol Chessmen was up there, and I used to talk to him through the ventilators. And early in 19, I was 18 or 19, and a sergeant brought an Argosy magazine around from death row, and they had excerpted the first chapter of Chessmen's book, Cell 2455, Death Row. It was a chapter about an execution, and it was unbelievable to me that a convict in prison, on death row, or just in prison, could get published in Argosy magazine, could accomplish that, and it mentioned that the book was going to be published. And when it was published, it was a smash bestseller internationally. So that's really what started me, you know, writing.
How did you get an agent when you were in prison?
I wrote this agent and told him that I was here in prison and I aspired to write, and they had done an issue in Esquire magazine about writer, the New York literary world, and they had a chart of, you know, how they do in magazines and these agents and that agent, and this was Ayn Rand's agent, originally had been Ayn Rand's agent, and was the real old agency in New York, one of the first ones. So I wrote them and explained my situation and if they'd be interested in reading my stuff. And so I sent it to them, and they said, we can't sell this. We do anything else, send it to us. So every time I'd write one of those novels, every two or three years, I'd send them when they'd say no. And finally, on the sixth one, he said, I think I can sell this, you know.
You wrote six novels before the one was published.
Right. I wrote for 17 years before I got published.
Did you show it to any of your fellow prisoners?
Oh, yeah. I was, I used to write dirty stories that I'd rent for cigarettes on the joint, too, you know. That's how I made my cigarettes, you know, and coffee. And I'd write reports. I always had, after a couple of years, I had very, you know, powerful clerical positions in the state prison. I was like, you know, associate warden's clerk, and because I could write so well. And, you know, those reports that go to Sacramento and the district attorney's office and things like that, so I did a lot of that writing, you know, report writing and stuff. And I would write letters for guys, and I got into law. I studied law. I worked as a law librarian for three or four years.
Well, your novel is about an unrepentant criminal. I imagine that didn't really help your reputation among prison authorities.
No. In fact, I once wrote an essay on how to commit an armed robbery, a primer on planning and commission of successful armed robberies. They found it in my cell. They really didn't like that. But I don't think they paid any attention to this book. I don't think they read very much. the prison authorities. And I wanted to write about an unrepentant criminal because there's a question always between how much is choice and how much is determined by life. I mean, I think my observation in life is that people who succeed always attribute their success to their own virtues, and people that fail always blame their failure on bad luck. And I don't know which is luck and which is virtue. And I wanted to be somebody that chose to be a criminal. I mean, I made my, whatever his predisposition by circumstances, I believe in free choice. He chose to be a criminal. I chose to be a criminal, you know, because I wouldn't be what society would let me be.
Well, actually, let me quote your character here. Your character says that he went to war with society and decided to be what he was with a vengeance, a criminal. Crime was where I belonged, where I was comfortable. Society had made me what I was, and I glorified in what I was. Did you feel that way?
Yeah, I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. I mean, you know, I wrote 200 letters once for a job, and I had a good education. You know, I score very high on all any kind of academic tests, and I type 100 words a minute. I can do a lot of things. And I wrote 200 letters. I didn't get one reply. They wanted to relegate me to a car wash. Once you're locked out of society, once you're an ex-convict and you're locked out of society, they're not going to let you in. You're not going to get to play the game. And so why not be a criminal?
Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm wondering, say, one of those times when you got out of prison, you ended up going back in. Say I owned some kind of business and I'd given you a managerial job there. Do you think you would have stolen from me?
Oh, no. No, I'm an honorable man. I'm very honorable. I'm more honorable than most of the people I deal with in Hollywood, you know. I'm certainly more honorable than an agent.
But you've stolen plenty of things. You've even done bank heist.
Right, I just take a gun and that's, you know, I put it in your face and take your money.
And then that's honorable?
Well, it's not dishonorable. You know, what's the difference of taking, morally, what's the difference of taking California from Mexico or taking money from a bank? Answer me. What's the moral difference?
Well, I mean, one's in your control and one isn't. You can't just kind of excuse your own personal acts
I don't
by
excuse
saying other
it.
People did it.
My character doesn't excuse it. I just put the realities of the world. I said my character chose to be a criminal. If
right.
you don't like it, then punish me, you know, or do what you
right.
can.
Right.
But I'm not going to, you know, cry and say, poor me, you know.
Right. No,
I didn't want to create that kind of character that said, you know, poor me, society, you know, I'm black, I'm this, I'm that, you know, and this is my justification. I said, I don't need any justification.
My guest is writer Edward Bunker. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1993 interview with Edward Bunker, a crime writer who served many years in prison. He has a new novel called Dog Eat Dog. Now, the novel No Beast So Fierce was first published in 1973. I believe you were paroled that year also?
Yeah.
Was that before or after the publication?
No, I was in when it was published.
And when were you paroled?
I was paroled later on, about a year and a half later.
Uh-huh. What was it like for you that time when you got out of prison? You know, you had a novel. You could have gone to a bookstore and bought looked at your book there.
Well, it was very different. I left in a limousine. They sent a limousine for me. We were going to make a movie. I was in pre-production of making Straight Time. And so they sent a limousine for me. That was a far different situation. Of course, they could have taken me around the block and dumped me out. I didn't care after they got away, you know. But my relationship with the world changed.
Was that the last time you were in prison?
Yep. And last time I was arrested.
In the introduction to your book, you thank Dustin Hoffman for carrying you for 6 months. You're referring to the time you worked with
another
him.
Book. That's in, you mean in the...
In your other book.
The dedication
yeah.
of
that's
Little
right.
Boy Blue. Yeah, he did. I mean, they hired me when I got out. They hired me as a technical consultant and paid me all the way through pre-production and production. gave me I did an acting job. I played a role in the movie, got a SAG card, and so it changed my life. I mean, it didn't change me, but it changed my relationship with the world. You know, I think I've changed kind of over time by virtue of the family. I've been with the same woman for 15 years. So I changed slowly, but when I got out, I didn't have any different attitude than I'd always had, but my relationship with society changed. I'd been on the cover of Harper's Magazine. I had a book published. I had another one in production. I had a movie being made. That's a whole lot of different situation than getting out, you know, with $40 in your pocket.
Tell me about one of the days when you got out with $40 in your pocket.
Oh, well, I got out one time with 40, and they'd given me the dress-out shoes. I was trying to get a job, and I remember this very clearly in Los Angeles. It was one of those hot L.A. days, you know, that really gets smoking 100 degrees. And I was walking around, and I had blisters from these shoes, these new cheap shoes that they'd given me, these dress-out shoes. And I'm walking from job application, trying to get a job. And it was so bad that I had blisters on my blisters, and no money, you know, in a little furnished room, and the rent's running out, and the parole officer's on my case, and
How long were you out?
That time?
Mm-hmm.
About 7 months, 8 months.
What landed you back in?
That time, I think I got caught with a safe in my car, a small safe. In the back of my car after a long chase and some checks from another safe burglary.
You pulled a bank heist once, right?
Yeah, I pulled several.
Uh-huh.
But the one that's really funny is the one I had in 72. I had been busted over the drugs, and I got out on bail, and they were following me, expecting me to pick up another load of drugs. And I was going to rob a bank in Beverly Hills and go to flee to Mexico. And I didn't know it, and they had a beeper on my car, a helicopter, and 5 carloads of narcs. And they followed me to a bank right on Wilshire Boulevard, right in the middle of Beverly Hills. And as I was robbing the bank, I looked up through the window, and there was some guy had his both hands, and he was pressed up to the glass looking in the bank from the street. And I recognized his face. I didn't know his name, but I recognized his face, and I knew it was a cop. So I ran out the other door, and the chase was on, you know, and I wondered why I couldn't get away. But, you know, the beeper and the helicopter. And they caught me over by Farmer's Market. And that was the worst. I thought I was going to get 20 years, 30 years. I thought it was all over. I was a 2-time loser with a, you know, ex-convict with a bank. That's as hot as it can get, you know. And while I was in the jail, they accepted my novel. And after over a few months, then people came to my assistant. I had a lot of letters, and I tried to kill myself that night. That's the bleakest point of my life. Yeah, because I thought it was all over. I tried to hang myself, and I used a piece of pajama top, and it broke. I went out. I went unconscious, you know, and I was hanging, and it broke. When I woke up, I was on the floor.
What were your first thoughts when you woke up?
I don't remember, you know, but, you know, I was dizzy, I guess, you know. Well, that didn't work.
Were you changed afterwards? Did you know?
No, was that a great metamorphosis that happened?
Yeah,
all of us? No,
no, no such luck, huh?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that change happens like that.
Yeah.
I don't believe in flashes of, you know, like lightning.
So you came to and you were still really depressed. You came to and you were still really depressed.
I was still really depressed, but things, you know, the world started slowly changing because I had accomplished something. Although I do know other people who have had, that kind of lightning. I had a guy I know that was doing time in California, and they took him to Nevada. When he finished his sentence, he had charges pending in Nevada, and he was facing a lot of time, and he said, he made one of those prayers, one of those deals with God, if I could get out of this, and I don't. It was an old crime, like he'd already served a sentence in California, and they were taking him there. Anyway, they dismissed the charges the next week, and he changed. He became a Christian minister, and he runs a home for abused children, and, you know, and that was kind of like lightning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one I know of.
You were on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list for a while?
Once upon a time, yeah.
What got you on there?
It was really some forgeries and suspicion of something that I wasn't guilty of, but it was really I was wanted for forgeries. Those were the was the charge.
Were you proud in a way? Did you feel like you'd made it to the top?
Well, it's kind of a not, I wouldn't say proud, but it scared me. I know that, but because it puts a lot more heat on you. They used to only put you on the 10 most wanted when they knew they were going to arrest you the next day.
To look impressive?
To look impressive. That's true, you know. And it kept me from going to Cuba. I was in Florida at the time in Miami, and it was when Castro was still in the mountains of in Cuba, and I thought I was going to go down there and join him.
To be a revolutionary?
Yeah. At that time, he was very favored by the United States. You know, he wasn't. In the late 50s, before he took over, while he was still in the Sierra Maestra, in the mountains up there, his press in the United States was very favorable.
Did
was pro Castro, huh? And I was going to be a revolutionary. Yes, and I was. You know, essentially, I wanted to get away from here. You know?
Did anybody recognize you from your 10 most wanted FBI photo that appeared in post offices when you were on
no,
the most
but
wanted
I was
list?
No, but I was afraid that they would.
Uh-huh.
That's what made me hesitant to try, and I didn't know it. And I was in Florida, I was in Miami, and I went into a post office and I saw my picture there. It scared me to death, and that's really the reason I didn't go. You know?
Did you run out of the post office?
No, I didn't quite, but I left quickly. You know what I mean? I don't think I quite ran, but it was. I got out of there. You know.
Was it a good photo?
No, it was a bad photo. But still, who knows, you know. Be surprised how many people, you know, recognize you.
Right. Do you think that although you don't commit crimes anymore, you'll be writing about them for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah, because that's what I know about, you know. I write about other things, too. I got a dog story, too, and I'm trying to hustle, you know. But essentially, I write about criminal. That's what, you know, Dostoevsky wrote. I mean, you know, after he went to prison for 7 years, that's what he wrote about. You know. That's what they tell you, you know, rule number one of creative writing, write about what you know.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, dear.
Edward Bunker recorded in 1993. Bunker's new novel, Dog Eat Dog, will be published later this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Charles Dutton, co-star of A Time to Kill, tells us how he learned to act while serving time in prison. Sean Penn tells us about playing a death row inmate in Dead Man Walking. And film critic John Powers reviews Manny and Lowe about two orphan runaways.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Dutton is now co-starring in the film A Time to Kill as Sheriff Ozzie Walls. Dutton is a graduate of Yale Drama School, but you could say his real alma mater is the Maryland State Penitentiary, where he spent 7.5 years. He was sent to prison in 1968 for manslaughter. He discovered his gift for acting while he was behind bars. He since received Tony nominations for his performances in August Wilson's plays The Piano Lesson and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. He starred in the sitcom Rock, which is now in syndication on BET, Black Entertainment Television. And he was featured in the films Nick of Time, Cry the Beloved Country, Low Down Dirty Shame, and Menace to Society. Our interview was recorded in 1992. You've had, as you know, a very extraordinary life. You spent several years in prison and went to reform school as a kid. And you once described it as a great place for an inner-city kid to get to play in the country or something along those lines.
What
did you find to like about reform school?
Well, you know, growing up in the, you know, inner city of Baltimore, you know, you didn't get out as a kid. You didn't get out to sort of enjoy the outdoors, you know. You know, I grew up in a housing project. You know, occasionally you may go to summer camp if your folks could afford it, or if it was a free summer camp, you know, once 1 week or 2 weeks in the summer. But when you went to reform school, you were, you know, in a rural area in the country where there were, you know, animals, livestock, and organized sports and three meals a day and two movies a week, and so to me, it was fun. To me, going to reform school was fun. Me and my buddies would actually organize our juvenile activities so that we went to court in early April or May just to spend 3 or 4 months in reform school.
It was like your version of summer camp.
It was a version of summer camp. It really was. And all your friends were there, you know. So, but what you don't realize as 11, 12, 13-year-old kid, that you're actually being conditioned at an early age to become a ward of the state. So that by the time you leave reform school, you're ready for the next level.
Prison.
You know, well, say if 13 or 14, there's always one more reform school stop. And that's 15 to 16-year reform school. But that's the middle one. And it gets tougher each time. But then you're ready for the next level because it's like the floodgates open and your friends go to the next level and then you go to the next level. And after that, you know, you're ready for the big leagues. And that is prison, you know.
Would you explain the story of how you got to prison?
Well, I went to reform school many times as a kid, for numerous things. Started at 12 years old for truancy and juvenile delinquency and being ungovernable and incorrigible, all those nice little words they use to describe one's behavior. When I was 17, I killed a guy in a fight. He nearly killed me, and I wrestled a knife from him, and I killed him. See, I lived and he died. That was a long, long time ago, nearly 23, 24 years ago. I did 2 years for manslaughter, and I was released, and then I went right back to prison a couple months later for possession of deadly weapons. I was convicted and sentenced to 3 years in prison. And while doing the 3 years in prison, I got into a fight with a correctional officer in the prison and was sentenced to an additional 8 years sentence. So they structured the sentencing, whereas I had to do the 3 year sentence first and then start on the 8 year sentence. So, you know, during that time, after I went back to prison the second time, I was what I consider a total knucklehead. You know, I was anti-authority. I had no respect for authority. I was a radical militant. You know, I really believed that there was going to be an armed overthrow of the United States government, and I was willing to die for that. You know, I was in the Black Panther Party. I was in a, one of the toughest prisons in the country at that time.
This is in Maryland?
In Maryland, Maryland State Penitentiary. It ranked in the top five of the toughest prisons in the country at that time. I never considered myself a vicious person. I never considered myself a person who did anything premeditatedly. The incident of the manslaughter charge was a situation, I was 17 years old, and it was just at a party, and a fight broke out, and me and this guy had a nice fight going on, and he pulled a knife and stabbed me several times. I wrestled it away from him and stabbed him.
What was your identity in prison before you became known as the actor and the one who organized the theater group? Who were you before?
Well, I was a troublemaker. Yeah, yeah. I was on the prison administration's hit list. I was beat up, brutalized by the guards, prison guards, more than once in those 7.5 years that I spent. I had my ribs broken, my nose broke, an ankle cracked, 2 fingers broke. I had my head bust 6-7 different times in prison. I had my teeth knocked out. I had my eye lacerated with 22 stitches across my eyebrow.
This is all by guards?
Over the course of time. All by prison guards, yeah. I got in a lot of fights in prison, too, with inmates. But once I became politically conscious, the inmate against inmate fighting stopped for me, at least. When I was in my, street stage, mentally, I got in fights with other inmates. But when I started to read in prison, I admittedly, I was reading strictly leftist literature, Mao Zedong, Marx and Engels, Lenin. It was through the reading of politics and societies and capitalism and socialism and what makes the world tick, you know, in economically, you know, that I began to understand what my condition was and what these people around me conditions were. And so inadvertently, I began to discover my own humanity by being a radical.
Let me ask you how you got from reading mostly leftist literature to reading plays and getting interested in performing.
Well, in 1972, a girlfriend sent me an anthology of black playwrights. At the time, I had no intention. I thought this decadent, capitalistic cultural exercise, I want nothing to do with it. And the book sat on my shelf in my prison for 4 or 5 months. And finally, I got in a little trouble in prison with a guard, and I was sentenced to 6 days in isolation, which is a little room with no light, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You were allowed one book to take. And I just reached back and grabbed the book, and I happened to pick that one up, and I read the book from cover to cover by the light that seeped under the door of the room, and it was a light shining in the hallway, and I just would lay down on my stomach at the door, and from the crack of the door, light, and turn the pages of the book, and got a little light to read from. And I was struck by one play that was so hilarious, a satire, a political satire called Day of Absence by Douglas Turner Ward. After reading this play, I had determined that when I got out of isolation, I was going to get the funniest characters in the prison that I knew and get these guys together and form a drama group. And we would put this particular play on at the prison talent show. And I got out of isolation on the 6th day, and I showed this play to a couple of guys. A couple of guys couldn't read, so I told them what the play was about. And the prison talent show came along, And it was a school teacher in the prison who was a local actress, a lady by the name of Diane Weaver. And so Miss Weaver, Mrs. Weaver, she supervised the group, and we started this drama group, and it changed my life.
Did that change your attitude about prison? Did you start really wanting to get out when you realized that there was something you really wanted to do?
Oh, it sure did. It sure did. And from that point on, I had stopped trying to find out how much time I could do and started trying to find out how much time I didn't have to do. And so I went, you know, I quit school in the seventh grade as a kid. So from that point, I went back and I went to the prison school and got my high school equivalency degree. Then I enrolled in the prison college program and got my 2-year college degree while in prison, an associate's arts degree. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever worried about ending up back in prison, or do you think that that's just out of the question?
Well, I mean, I don't plan to do anything to get me back there. There is nothing that anyone can tell me about prison anymore. I have a PhD in prison life, you know. So there's no reason for me to go back. I don't hang out in the same circles. I'm not in the same company of guys who go in and out. I still have lots of friends who are in prison. They'll be my friends for as long as I'm on this planet. Guys on the street corners in Baltimore, you know, guys who are still using drugs, selling drugs, shooting drugs, and those people will always be my friends, you know. I'm hoping and praying that the ones who are involved in the negative things will eventually retire from it and see their lives in a different light and say, okay, I've had enough, you know. But if they don't, I can't be the one to judge.
Charles Dutton, recorded in 1992. He plays Sheriff Ozzy Walls in the new film A Time to Kill. Coming up, Sean Penn. This is Fresh Air. Sean Penn gave a memorable performance as a convict on death row in the film Dead Man Walking, which just came out on home video. Susan Sarandon played Sister Helen Prejean, who becomes a spiritual advisor to men on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola. Sean Penn played Matthew Poncelet in the final days before his execution. Poncelet was convicted of brutally murdering a couple on Lover's Lane. He's unrepentant about his crimes and unapologetic about his racism, as you can hear in this scene between Sarandon and Penn.
Is your daddy a racist?
What kind of question is that?
We have to teach a child to hate, and I was just wondering who taught you.
I don't like niggas.
Have you ever known any black people?
Sure, I did. That was all around when I was a kid.
All around?
They lived around me.
Did you ever play with a black child?
No. But me and my cousin got jumped pretty good once.
What happened?
We just throw rocks at them. So the next day, they wait that chance, get a hold of our bikes, tear them up.
Can you blame them?
Well, no, but look, slavery's long over. They always harping on what a bad deal they got.
The kids that tore up your bike?
All of them. I can't stand people make themselves out to be victims.
Victims?
Yeah, they all victims.
I don't know any victims in my neighborhood. I know some pretty cool people, decent, hardworking.
Yeah, I know a lot of lazy, welfare-taking coloreds sucking up tax dollars.
You sound like a politician.
What's that mean?
You ever been the object of prejudice?
No.
What do you suppose people think about inmates on death row?
I don't know. Why don't you tell me?
They're all monsters. Disposable human waste. Good for nothing. Sucking up tax dollars.
Yeah, but I ain't no victim. They're gonna kill me. I'm innocent. I ain't whining. I ain't sitting on no porch going slavery. I like rebels. Some blacks is okay. Martin Luther King, he led his people all the way to D.C. He kicked the white man's butt.
You respect Martin Luther King?
But he put up a fight. He wasn't lazy.
What about lazy whites?
Don't like him.
So it's lazy people you don't like.
Can we talk about something else?
Fine acting comes out of the powers of observation. Earlier this year, I asked Sean Penn what he observed during his own brief stays in jail.
Well, I was in a Mono County jail where I had 8 cellmates. In the L.A. County jail, my situation there was a PC unit, which is not politically correct, but protective custody.
Right.
Where you would have some contact whenever meal breaks would happen and that sort of thing. And it tended to be, you know, I was the one there who was saying to myself, am I a threat to society? Because the reason that most of the guys are particularly in that unit is because they're high-profile, high-crime guys. And so the guys that I spent some time in there with were guys that had done the kinds of things that are played out in this movie. And there is a kind of brilliant mask of denial that goes on, I think to a large degree, often believed by the perpetrator. You know, where you're talking to somebody and they're just declaring their innocence, and they, more than lying, they believe their lie.
And that's something your character does, too.
Quite a bit.
Were you treated like a celebrity inside?
Oh, I was treated the way that people would like to treat celebrities when they have the opportunity to, and they're the kind of people who work in these, you know, I mean, there was a decent screw or two, as it were, but mostly it's people who like to, you know, you'd be sitting on the commode, and they'd like to tap on the glass and say, look, there's Sean Penn relieving himself, you know. It's not pleasant.
You grew up around show business. Your father wrote and directed for Starsky and Hutch in Lost in Space?
You know, he's just a director.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he had done all the sort of hour-long serial television stuff.
Oh, what else? What else?
Oh, he's still doing it. He's still doing Matlocks, and Barnaby Jones is from the past, and he did Bonanzas and Gunsmokes, and just about Marcus Welby, M.D., just about any sort of serial television show from the late 50s from the 60s and through the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Was your father blacklisted?
Yes.
And had he refused to testify to UAC, or?
He did, and he was a communist.
Uh-huh. How did your parents explain the blacklisting period when you were growing up?
Oh, I think fairly literally. You know, I mean, my dad is a kind of, speaks like a history teacher. And so we, you know, heard it from the whole use of the Red Scare for certain political advantages of people and who the individuals were, as well as particulars of, you know, the people like Kazan and those people who were really deep-pocketed betrayers of France.
What financial impact did the blacklisting have on your family?
Well, it wiped my dad out for about 5 years. He just couldn't work in the business, period. My mother wasn't blacklisted, so she went in and started working on television. And by the time he could work again, any kind of momentum he'd had as an actor was pretty well shot. And that's when he started directing. He had a friend who helped him out into directing.
I see. Did he have to work under a pseudonym at all?
No, he worked under a pseudonym as a script doctor for a while. But he was also the blacklist. Had first caught him out here in Los Angeles. He was a contract player at various times, the Ida Lupino and the King Brothers out here, and that wiped him out of being able to work in movies. So he was able to go to New York and work on stage for a little while, and then it caught up with him there. He didn't use a pseudonym. He was able to linger on in the theater for a little while, and then it caught up there pretty heavy, and he couldn't work there either, so he started working in a plastics factory.
So did the blacklisting experience affect you politically when you were growing up?
I think my father affected me politically when I was growing up. I think he had a clear dignity about him, and is not a bitter person. And what didn't report, you know, what had happened to him with personal bitterness towards these people. It's very matter of fact. This is what happened. This is why he thought people did what they did. And this is what the effects of it were. And I think that there is a kind of deep loyalty and honesty that he and integrity he has as a man that was affecting. But I couldn't specifically attribute it to the blacklist. I mean, he was one among many people who'd gone off, you know, just a couple of years before they couldn't work in their own country. They'd gone off and been highly decorated for fighting for their country in World War II. So that whole irony of that and the way that he still believed in the country when it was all over.
I don't know if you read this piece or not, but James Wolcott, the film and literary critic, wrote in Vanity Fair. He did a profile of you in Vanity Fair, and he wrote that there's a spot of middle-class softness in Sean Penn that he seems to be armoring himself against. He says, but that doesn't make him a sham. Actors become what they pretend, holding something of their own in reserve. Do you feel that there was any truth in that, that you've been, that you had a spot of middle-class softness that you seem to be armoring yourself against?
I think I'm dominated by middle-class softness. But I would say, you know, there's a great Bukowski poem. There's a bluebird in my heart. He wants to get out, but I pour whiskey on him, and I won't let him. You know, I mean, but in jail, you're not spending a lot of time exercising your softness.
If you don't mind my saying this, you seem to be really kind of thoughtful and intelligent in your, you know, in your take on things and your approach to acting and directing and writing. And yet over the years, I think your media image has been as someone who's you know, who's kind of a jerk in some ways. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, it's something Bukowski said on that also, which is, I know I'm good, so let them think I'm bad. It gives me dimension.
Well, do you,
you know, I don't care. I mean, I do know all that stuff, but, you know, when they walk in my shoes, I'll listen.
Sean Penn recorded last January. His film Dead Man Walking is now out on video, as is the film The Crossing Guard, which he directed. Penn is now in production with the film She's the Lovely, the last film written by the late John Cassavetes. Here's a song from the Dead Man Walking soundtrack by Steve Earle, our guest earlier this week.
Well, I've seen them fight like lions, boys. I've seen them go like lambs. And I've helped to drag them when they could not stand. And I've heard their mamas crying when they heard that big door slam. And I've seen the victim's family holding hands. Last night I dreamed that I woke up with straps across my chest. And something cold and black pumped through my lungs. And even Jesus couldn't save me, though I know he did his best. But he don't live on LS Union 1. Swing low, swing low, swing low and carry me home. Swing low, don't let go. Swing low and carry me home.
Coming up, a review of Manny and Lo. This is Fresh Air. It's been a season of one big summer film after another, with more to come. Our critic John Power says it's time for a breather. Manny and Lo, a new independent film about two sisters, might be just the ticket.
A few years ago, I was interviewing a director about his latest picture. "Whatever you do," he said, "please don't call it a good little movie. I'd rather you called it a big bad movie. At least that sounds exciting. But good and little? Who wants to see something like that?" Which is precisely the challenge facing Manny and Lo, a winning low-budget film about the search for family. It's the story of two orphan sisters, Manny, a reflective 11-year-old, and punky Lo, a 16-year-old who's as feisty and profane as her sister is pensive. When the movie begins, they've run away from their foster homes and are bombing around the countryside in an old family car. They sleep on lawns, shoplift from convenience stores, and periodically check for their photos on cartons of milk. They're sure the law's hot on their trail. But when Lo turns out to be unexpectedly pregnant, they hole up in an empty vacation home deep in the woods. And to help Lo have her baby, they kidnap a woman named Elaine, a fussy know-it-all clerk at a local baby store, amusingly played by Mary Kay Place. Manny and Lo bind her ankles with a bicycle chain to keep her from escaping. But Elaine is actually as lost as they are, and she soon takes on the role of surrogate mother, giving Lo pregnancy tips and reminding Manny that crime doesn't pay. To the girl's surprise, she even starts cooking their meals.
What do you think it is?
I've no idea.
It's called hot dish, and it's for eating, not poking. I believe kidnapped victims have just as much right to a balanced meal as anyone else. And if I'm not mistaken, the same holds true for innocent babies. If you two benefit in the process, well, that can't be helped.
Manny and Lo is the first feature by Lisa Krueger, a young writer-director with a very light touch. She knows her story is as fragile as a bubble, and she takes care to handle it gingerly. The movie is filled with droll, slightly askew jokes, like that meal being called hot dish, or Elaine's silly baby steps as she walks around the house with a chain around her ankles. The emotions are understated, too. With its three lonely heroines, this is the kind of movie that could easily become soppy. But Krueger gets a tough performance from Alexa Palladino as the headlong Lo, and a placidly eloquent turn from Scarlett Johansson as Manny, the movie's moral center. In one of the film's key metaphors, she keeps looking at the world through a magnifying glass. When film people call something a women's picture or girls' movie, they invariably mean something insulting, that it's shamelessly weepy or obsessed with romantic relationships. Manny and Lo is not a women's picture. It's something better, a picture about women. Men figure in the plot only tangentially. In one of the most revealing scenes, Lo has sex with her boyfriend in his monster truck. When they finish, he thanks her, and Lo snaps, "I didn't do it for you." 5 years ago, Thelma and Louise created a stir when they plunged into the Grand Canyon rather than turn over their freedom to the world of men. Manny and Lo seems like a deliberately non-apocalyptic response to such suicidal flamboyance. Its heroines want to believe that someone is looking for them, when the truth is, nobody's interested. Nobody except one another. And so Manny, Lo, and Elaine create a new kind of family, in which words like mother and daughter are defined not biologically, but by caring, intimacy, and need. I don't want to give Lisa Krueger the kiss of death, but this is a good little movie.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Reform Party will hold two conventions this month, culminating in the nomination of its presidential candidate. The nominee may be the party's founder, Ross Perot. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Gerald Posner, author of Citizen Perot, a new biography of the Texas billionaire. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.